Okay, we start here on the bottom of Nun Hei Amud Bet, four lines up, last two words on the line. Minolan, where do we know this from? Here we're discussing the position of Rabbi Yehuda. We're trying to understand why Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah only has one kan and not two kanim. Why does he have only one base near the Mizbech HaZahav and not two bases? The suggestion of the Gemara until this point was Rabbi Yehuda Leilei Ktiva. Rabbi Yehuda does not rely on labeling. He says people don't pay attention to labeling, so we do not trust labeling. We tried to bring a proof from that from Shkalim. Rabbi Shkalim, Rabbi Yehuda does not allow you to have both stuck a box or a box for Kenei Chuva and for Kenei Nidava, because we're afraid that you're going to get mixed up. The Gemara rejected that explanation and said the problem was that the Kenei Chuva, you have a problem of Chatat Shemetu Baaleha. First we thought maybe they might die, and then we said no, it must be that they definitely died, and therefore we have a problem. So we rejected the explanation that labeling is the issue over here, but rather the problem is a problem of Breira. The Gemara asks, the problem is Chatu Shemetu Baaleha, just take out the money that was assigned to this individual and throw it out. Once you've thrown it out, then everything else is fine. But he says we can't do that because Leilei Breira. He says we can't, after the fact, make an assignment of the money to this particular individual and rectify the situation. So now the Gemara wants to know, Minolan, how do we know that Rabbi Yehuda does not subscribe to this position of Breira? If you think it comes from this Mishnah, person who purchases wine from the Kutim, Erev Shabbat, late on Erev Shabbat, with nightfall, near Ben Hashmashot, either right before Ben Hashmashot or in Ben Hashmashot. Tosafot over here discusses with regards to the status of Kutim. Later on, there's a point in time where the Kutim became Goyim Legamre, where Chazal assigned them a complete sense of Goyim, but earlier on, there's a machloket whether they were Gerei Arayot or Gerei Amet, whether they were actual real converts, or were they converted out of pressure under duress because of the lions that were running loose with them in the time of the Nevi'im, which is described in Sefer Melachim. Tosafot discusses that both according to Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, the different positions that we have in this Braita that we're about to quote, and how we reconcile those positions with the fact that you're buying wine from a kuti over here. The other thing is, we have the word Detznan over here, because there is a Mishnah in Demai that is somewhat similar to this Mishnah. Tosafot argues that it should say Tanya, it should say Breita over here, because the complete quote which we're bringing over here is not found in the Mishnah, and therefore he thinks it's a Breita, not a Mishnah. He wants to eat this on Shabbat. The problem is he has to take off Trumot, Masrot, all these items before he drinks from the wine. But he's too late in the day. He's running out of time, or as Rashi says, he has no Kelim left. He's used all his Kelim to prepare for Shabbat. And he can't separate out the Trumot and Masrot into separate utensils because he doesn't have any more utensils left right before Shabbat. Says Omer, Shnei Lugim Shani Atid Lafrish. Those two log, which I am in the future going to take off, are in Truma. Truma is either 1/40th, 1/50th, or 1/60th of the produce. If you take the Benoni, it's 1/50th, which is 2%. So here he says two log. We're assuming that he has 100 log here. Two log is 2% of the total. Then Asara, 10 that I'm going to take off in the future is Maaser Rishon. Maaser is 10% of the total. As Tosafot points out, this is Lav Dafka, because after you've taken off 2%, then 10% is only 9.8, not 10. It's just a clean or easy way to express it. And then Maatisha Maaser Shini, 9 will be Maaser Shini. Once again, that's Lav Dafka. That's only if you're starting from 100 is 9 Maaser Shini. But if you've already taken off 2% beforehand, then you're going to have less than that when it comes to Ma'aser Sheni. Umechal. Then he, Rashi says, redeems it. B'shoteh miyad divir Rabbi Meir. And he can drink it right away. That's the words of Rabbi Meir. Now, Rashi explains that Mechal means that he redeems it, which is somewhat difficult, and Tosafot points this out. Tosafot contrasts this Mishnah with a Mishnah of Alokeach me'am ha'aretz, someone who purchased wine from an am ha'aretz in the same scenario. We say every week in Bamei Madikim, if you have Trumot Masrot Vadai, Ben Hashmashot, you cannot be mafrish them, you cannot take them off. Safecha shecha, safecha inecha shecha, masrim et ha-damai, vein masrim et ha-vadai. You're allowed to take off maaser from something that is damai, safek, which you buy from the Amaretz, not from things that are vadai. So Tosafot says over here, this is a situation where we're talking about vadai. Because you know it's from the Kutim, and they for certain did not take it off. The reason they didn't take it off is because Kutim are interesting individuals. When they believe something's true in the Torah, they carry it out to the nth degree. You can trust them completely. The only question is here, when it comes to Trumot and Masrot, they believe that you do have to take Trumot and Masrot off, but only if you're eating it yourself. If you sell it to a third party or give it to a third party, you do not have to take off Trumot Umasrot. We believe that you have to take off Trumot Umasrot because of Lifnei Iver, Lo Titen Michshol. Because otherwise you're going to cause another party a problem because you're selling them Tvalim, which we don't allow you to do. There's a number of issues. One is that we don't let you do business with Tevel or Trumot Umasrot, so you have to mafrish beforehand. Number two is, if you give it to someone else, they're going to trip up. It's Lifnei Iver, Lo Titen Michshol. They do not believe in that Isur, and therefore they have no problem selling you Tvalim, and not having any issue of being mafrish, the Trumot Umasrot. So that's why we're talking about Vadai Trumot Umasrot over here. And we're not talking, as Tosafot says, like an Amaretz. An Amaretz will take off the Truma because they're worried about Mita Bidei Shemayim, and it's a token amount. Masrot, they think big deal. It's not stealing. This is a human or psychological thing that everybody does. Many people would not steal from an individual directly. They wouldn't go into someone's house and take something. They would not steal when it came to someone else's object that's sitting around. But when it comes to an institution or the public in general, they have no problem stealing. The same thing here with the Amei Aretz is that they won't steal. They believe in Lo Tigzol, but they have no issue not giving the Maaser Rishon or giving the Maaser Ani, whatever belongs to those individuals. That's Mamon She'en Lo Tovim. It's money that has no claimant or no direct claimant, and therefore they have no problem keeping it. So the Amei Aretz are Mafrish Truma, but not Masrot or Trumat Maaser. So that's a difference between an Amei Aretz and the Kuti. And he says the Kuti will not make that difference, because he says if the Kuti is going to be Mafrish, he's going to be Mafrish everything. If he doesn't think he has to be Mafrish, he's going to be Mafrish nothing. As opposed to the Amei Aretz, who has this middle ground where he says, I'm going to get rid of the Truma, but I'm not going to do the Masrot. So because of that difference, Tosafot says the Didim are different. One is about this Benes Mashot. He notes a number of differences. One of them is this issue of being Mechal, of redeeming it on Shabbat itself. First of all, he says, you cannot redeem Maaser Sheni unless it has a designated space. So in the Mishnah with the Amei Aretz, it says Maaser Sheni Bidromo, Bitzfono. It gives a designated location for the Maaser Sheni. And because of that, you can redeem it. Over here, if you look in our Mishnah Brayta, it just says Maaser Sheni, without giving it any designated location. That's number one. Number two is, he says, you can't redeem it on Shabbat. Now, if it's already mufrash and separated, then to say that it's mechal, that it's redeemed on the money, is no big deal, Benesh Mashot. But if it's not yet separated, even without the issue of the fact you can't redeem something that's not separated on Shabbat, we're not going to let you then redeem it, because that looks like a hafrasha. That looks like you're actually doing something on Shabbat, and we won't allow that to happen. So Tosafot says the word mechal here cannot mean redeemed. So he gives two options as to what the word mechal means. He says either mechal comes from the word hechel. Hechel in the Torah means to begin. Umechal v'shoteh. He begins to drink. Not that he redeems it, but rather now that he's done all of this, he can begin to drink it. Or the Rabbeinu Meshulam says that it means mechal with a hey. It's misspelled. It's not with a chet, but with a hey. Which means to be mazog. It means to dilute the wine. Mechal v'shoteh. Then you can mix it and drink it. So Tosafot's looking for an alternative for the word mechal instead of being redeemed, which is what Rashi says. He disagrees with Rashi's interpretation. It says either it means begin or dilute, because otherwise it would not be permissible in this case. And again, he is looking at the distinction between what would be by an Amei Aretz, which is a fake Trumot Masrot. We know that Rov Amei Aretz Masrim Hay, number one. Number two is we know they took off Truma Gedola. So you have a different scenario in the Mishnah with the Amei Aretz. Here's a Kuti who's not taking off Truma, and we don't have Rov Kuti and Masrim Hay when they're selling it to you. If they're eating it themselves, you're okay. But if they're selling you a third party, there's no chance they took off Trumot Masrot. There's no Safek here. We're dealing with Vadai Tevel. So because of that, we allow you Benesh Mashot, or a little before Benesh Mashot, really have to be here, because this is Vadai Tevel. It have to be done a little before Benesh Mashot. We're going to allow you to deal with this issue in this manner because he doesn't have Kelim, and we want him to have it ready for Shabbat. Rabbi Meir says, this is totally fine. On the other hand, we have three Tanaim who disagree. Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yossi, Vir Rabbi Shimon, Osrim. All of them say that is problematic. Alma, what would you conclude? The reason is that they think this is problematic. Rabbi Meir says, no problem. You'll do this after the fact. You'll take off your trumot, your matzrot, everything after the fact. That's what you would call breira. Breira is you've determined what is truma after the fact. Not when you're drinking it, but later on. So what it seems like is Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, who are osrim, Alma ain't breira. They don't subscribe to breira, and that's why they do not permit you to do such a thing. This is brought throughout Shas. Every time the Gemara wants to deal with breira, they bring this Mishnah Brayta down, and they say the same thing. We can prove from here that they don't have breira, and the Gemara answers the same thing throughout Shas, which is, Mimai, Dilma Shani Hotom, Kidatani Taimo. Maybe it's different over there, because they're writing the reason. Amrulo the Rabbi Meir. The Braita continues, and they say to Rabbi Meir what their position is premised on. Don't you worry about the fact that the flask might burst. This all works great if, after the fact, the residual is still there, because then you can assign that to Trumot, Masrot, and so on and so forth. What happens if the flask, whatever it's held in, breaks or something happens to it, and now there's nothing left? That means, l'mafreya, you drank tevel, because you are now never going to be mafrish the Trumot and Masrot that were there because they've disappeared. V'nin seshotet valim l'mafreya, and it'll turn out to be drinking tevel retroactively. Amohem b'shiv baka. Okay, when it breaks, we'll worry about it. The mayor's answer is, that's not shchiach, that's not a common occurrence. It's not a common occurrence, we're not going to worry about it.
What if he drinks?
You have the same problem if he drinks it all. We're generally not worried about him making a mistake to finish it off. We're assuming that he'll do the right thing here. The Shivaka note is something that's out of his control, and therefore we worry about the fact that it might happen. Rameer says that's not a common occurrence. Since it's not a common occurrence, we don't consider it. We don't concern ourselves with that, and therefore it works. What would be implied from this is that everybody holds a Breira. The problem is just whether we worry about whether you can carry out the retroactive separation of the Trumot and Masrot. Tosafot asks here, what was the Gemara thinking? The Breita itself says, don't you worry about the flask breaking. Why does the Gemara throughout Shas think this is talking about Breira when it's clear that they state the position or explicitly make the comment about why they have this position? So Tosafot says, and he lists throughout Shas numerous occasions, where many times people don't argue their main reason. That their main reason is otherwise, and yet they still argue with the person about something else on the side. They want to convince the other person to join their side or to relent on their opinion. So how do they do that? They make all different types of arguments. Okay, look, you don't like that one, we'll do this one, we'll do this one, this one. Even though they personally may not even subscribe to that position. They just want to change their mind. So he says that maybe the Gemara was thinking that. Yeah, Rabbi Meir, the reason that they can't get him over, oh, the Mafreya Breira issue. All right, let's work on him about this Yivaka Anod business. So they're not giving the Gemara thinks that that's not their main reason, that's just a sideshow, trying to convince Rabbi Meir to change his mind. But the real issue is Breira. And the Gemara rejects that and says, no, the real issue here is Yivaka Anod. So now we're left without a proof to this issue of whether Rabbi Yehuda holds a Breira or not. We stated before, Rabbi Meir doesn't hold a Breira. We don't know it from this Mishnah or Breita. Now we have to try something else. Ella, Meditani Ayo. So from the Mishnah or Breita of Ayo from Eruvin, Meditani Ayo, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ein Adam Matneh Ashnei Devarim Keachad. The person can't make two conditions at once. Ella, Ein Bachacham LaMizrach, Eruvo LaMizrach. If the Chacham comes in the east, his Erev is in the east, Ma'arav, Eruvo Ma'arav. But if he comes to the west, it's in the west. But if he comes to both places, not. So now, this is the statement of Rabbi Yehuda. Over there, the Gemara offers a person the alternative to say, he'll lay out two Eruvin, and he'll say, if the Chacham comes on the western side, my Eruv is to the west. If the Chacham comes from the eastern side, my Eruv will be to the east. If they come from both sides, then I'll choose which one it is. Implying that there is Breira over here, that after the fact they can make a decision about which way it goes. Now, Rabbi Yehuda's statement is somewhat difficult here in Ayo because he says, you can't do this business where you go Lakan or Lakan. You can't say, I'll make my decision up afterwards about which one I'll go to if the Chacham comes from both sides. Yet, he still says in the first part of it, if you lay it out in the east and the west, that seems to work. He says, you can't have both of them at once, but if the Chacham comes on the west side, that's fine, or if he comes on the east side, that's fine. But that's equivalent or the same Breira issue. All he did was he put out two Eruvin, and in that case, the Chacham comes in the west, so he picked the western one. Came to the east, so he picked the eastern one. But that all happened after he already laid out the Eruvin. So that's something that's being decided after the fact. There is a problem, there's an inconsistency in Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. One is where he says that they're both sides, says doesn't work, because it seems to be that he doesn't hold the Breira. But in the first case, where it comes to the east or west, he says, oh, that works fine. Even though that's also working on Breira, which is that after the fact, you're going to determine which one was viable, the eastern or the western one. So that the Gemara asks, and it says, wait a minute, Avinaba, Maishna Lakan Lakan Dolo, why when it comes on both sides do we say not, the Ein Breira? Because there's no Breira. L'mizrach l'marav nami Ein Breira. When you go to the east or the west, you're still functioning under Breira. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan. Yochanan says, Bikshivar b'chacham, that the Chacham already came. Which means in the case of Mizrach l'marav, before Ben Hashmashot, the Chacham already showed up, either on the eastern side or on the western side. Now, by doing that, before Ben Hashmashot, the Erev took effect. Now, L'mafreya is not really L'mafreya anymore. All you have to do is what's called a Giloy Milta. You have to reveal the information of what already took place. The Chacham came before Shabbat, the onset of Shabbat, so therefore, at Ben Hashmashot, either you're one to the east or to the west took effect. You may not know that information, But it's not that that information is being decided after the fact. It's already decided. You just have to find out what the information was or which one took effect. So that is permissible. On the other hand, when the case of the Kan on the Kan, then both Eruvim technically are taking effect. You later on make a decision on Shabbat. If you go to the east, then the one in the west is no good and the one east is good. If you go to the west, it's the opposite way around. That is a classic case of Breira, because you're deciding on Shabbat retroactively which Eruv took effect ben Hashmashot. That Rabbi Yehuda does not allow. So here we have our proof, first of all. Just let's take a step back. In terms of Rabbi Yehuda, it's clear here he does not subscribe to Breira. And this is the proof that he doesn't subscribe to Breira. That's number one. Number two is, why is this called Breira? This is a question you have to ask over here. Why is the first case, and that's what David was trying to argue here, why is that first case really a case of Breira? Now, the question really is, how do I separate between what's called a Tanai, a condition, and Breira, and retroactive decision-making? How do I distinguish between something which is simply a condition in the contract, or a condition in whatever I'm trying to carry out, versus something that is retroactive decision-making? So Rashi lays out a methodology for determining how you make that distinction. This is what Tosafot deals with over here. He's dealing with that issue, as well as another distinction within Breira. The first one he brings, he quotes from Rashi in Gittin, and in this Tosafot, the big Tosafot on the Amud Aleph, in the end, he moves away from it, and in the end, he comes back and says, Rashi's right, and that is the right way to explain it, which is Rashi says the following. Atam dechoshiv le-breira. When is it called breira? V'shum dein ze kashar tanaim shadam matne beget shebiyado lekaimo. This is not like conditions in a get where a person has control over the outcome. Something's called a tanai, when you have the ability to determine the outcome of the situation. When you can influence the outcome and make the outcome take place, that's called a tanai. Ushum atne alehem urshinit kaima tanai have a get the mafreya. So if you put conditions in a get, for instance, this is a get if I pay you $100, if I pay you 100 shekel, this is a get. Is that breira? Meaning that after the fact when he pays the money, we find out this is a get? No, that's a get with a condition. Because he has the ability to pay the money or not pay the money. So since it's in within its control, that's not called retroactive determination of the effectiveness of the get. The get is effective immediately, pending the accomplishment of the condition built into the get. That's called a condition because you control that. On the other hand, of a hocha, the ein biado, it's not in your control. Ubishata tanai hu safek. And therefore, at the time that you lay out the conditions, you have no clue what's going to take place. But tanai mitzkayem me'elav. And the condition takes place by itself. So therefore, in the cases of Neuvin, it's out of his control. It's not within his control because he has no idea which side the chacham is coming from. He's relegating this out of his control to the chacham, basically, or where the chacham shows up. So once he's done that, it's no longer a condition in his Eruv, but rather it becomes a limafreya, a retroactive determination, because he's waiting for information that he does not possess. And that information that he does not possess puts it out of his control, and since it's out of his control, therefore it's called breira, and not called tanai. That's a very important distinction, because this is important to know. When something is a effective contract or get, or stipulation, just with conditions, versus when something is breira, when something is a retroactive effectiveness of whatever you're stipulating. So that's one distinction that Rashi makes. The Ramban in Gittin disagrees with Rashi. He says that's not the way to describe the difference. Ramban gives you a different way to distinguish between them, and he says that the difference between them is a tanai is binary. A tanai is either yes, it will happen, no, it will not happen. You only have two choices. It will be effective or will not be effective. Breira is where there are multiple possibilities of outcomes. There are more than one outcome where it can be a positive outcome. So over here, in the case where you have a get and you say, I'm going to pay the money, so over there, there's only two outcomes. Either you do pay the money or you don't pay the money. It's a binary option, and therefore, that's a tanai, that's a condition. Over here by the Eruvin, you have two cases. In the second case, it's obvious. When you have the chacham coming from both sides, then you have multiple options over there. Because then you have either no Eruv, or Eruv to the east, Eruv to the west. You have all these options that are going to come up. So that's called Breira. The one question is, in the case of Mizrach and Ma'arav, over there are only two options. Either your Eruv is on the east, or your Eruv is on the west. Over there it is binary. Others argue that even the Ramban will agree that's Breira because it's not really two options. Two options means in a single item, you have two options. Over here, you really have multiple options. It's on the east, yes or no. On the west, yes or no. So really, that's more than two options. It's not really a binary option there, because each one on the east and west has a binary aspect to it, and therefore you're already dealing with multiple options, and it's called Breira. That's the way the Ramban distinguishes between something that's a condition, and that's something that's called Breira. Right now, in addition to that, Tosafot adds in a different layer here. He's trying to reconcile, and this is a problem throughout Shas. Whenever we bump into this Braita, you have here Rabbi Meir, who clearly subscribes to Breir over here, in this Mishnah or Braita. And then you have the other opinions here, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon, who in the end seem to subscribe to Breir, but at least in the Havamin and the Gemara thinks they do not subscribe to Breir. And what Tosafot points out is that they are not consistent throughout Shas. We find places where Rabbi Meir does not subscribe to Breira, and we find places where Rabbi Huda does subscribe to Breira. So how do I reconcile between those differences? So Tosafot brings a distinction up front, building on top of Rashi's distinction. First layer of distinction is, am I dealing with a Tanai, or am I dealing with Breira? So that solves a number of your problems, because I may be dealing with conditions and not Breira. The second level that he builds on top of that is, and this is this large Tosafot on Amud Aleph, and on Amud Bet, he goes at it again. In a case where a person puts a condition in and makes it clear what he's doing over here, there we're going to dictate and say there is lemafreya, according to Rabbi Meir. There, mafreya works because I've stipulated exactly how I want it to work up front. How it's going to play out, what the script is, that works for lemafreya and that works as breira. On the other hand, when something happens memela, where there is no speaking, there is no determination by scripting, over there, we have a safek as to whether Breira works or not. So for instance, in a case where Achim Shiarshu, brothers that inherit their father. So now, when they go and divide the estate, how do we view them? We've seen this numerous times in the Shas. Are they considered to be Lochim, purchasers at that point in time, when they divide the estate? Or are they considered to be Yorshim at that time period? Do we say Lamafreya, this is the designated part of the estate that belonged to them all along? Or do you say, no, they have a mixed estate here, and when they divide the property now, they're basically buying and selling from each other to create it. So over there, Rabbi Meir says, it's a fake. I don't know if we say Breira. What do you mean, no? We have a Mishnah Breita here that says clearly he thinks Breira works. So Tosafot says, over here, he scripted the whole item. He says exactly how the Breira is going to lay out. That's why Breira works over here for sure. For the case of the brothers, they didn't make any decisions up front. It just happened. Now they're dividing the estate. There's nobody saying, oh, we're purchasers now. We're Yoshim now. It's something that happens without any intent, without any pre-scripting. And so because of that, there he has a safek with regards to Breira. So Tosafot uses those two items to distinguish between different cases in Shas. One is, again, the idea of pre-scripted versus just happening in Memela. That's an important distinction. And then the other one, which is Rashi's distinction, something that was within your control, and something that is not in your control. Tosafot uses that distinction in other places like Asmach Dolokanya. With Asmach Dolokanya, whether you have control over the situation or don't have control over the situation, how willing is a person to give a kinyan when they think they can control the situation versus when they know it's out of their control? He says, most people, when it's out of their control, will just say, listen, I'm done. This is the kinyan. I understand the kinyan is effective because I can't control it anymore. People think when they have an ability to affect it, that they don't give it over fully because they think they're going to control the outcome. In an instance where somehow discussing what's going to be the outcome of the situation, and he thinks he's going to be able to solve the situation and not have to pay the money or not have to do this, then in that situation we say, Asmach Dolokanya, because he thinks he's in control. If you know it's totally out of your control, then you relinquish control, and you say, I don't care anymore, so Asmachta is Kanya. Tosafot makes that same decision in Asmachta as he's making here between Breira and Tanai. It's the mindset of individuals, the psychology of how they view things when they're out of their control versus when they're in their control. How much control do they think they have and whether they can influence the outcome of situation. So through those two things, Tosafot tries to solve or reconcile all the different cases of Breira throughout Shas. He has some difficulty, to be honest, because he finds cases where it doesn't exactly match, so he works his way through this idea. And you can see that in the Tosafot on the bottom of Nun Vav Amud Bet. He talks about Rabbi Yochanan's position versus Rav and Eruvin, about whether they subscribe to this difference between Tola B'dat Tzmo and Tola B'dat Tachimim, that distinction that Rashi made, and he works it out, that both everybody holds of it. Because he wants everybody to subscribe to this difference, because that helps him solve a lot of problems throughout Shas. Right now, the Gemara comes back. V'hasha Damrina. Right now we solved one problem. We said, with regards to the boxes for the Kinei Chova and the Kinei Nidava, the reason that Rabbi Yehuda does not have them there is not because he doesn't rely on labeling, but because in Breira, and there's a problem of possibility of Chatat Shemetu Balea. But now we have to come back to our situation over here, because Hak Tiva Itle, now we say that according to Yehuda, labeling does work, because he has the 13 shofarot in the Mikdash, so he knows labeling works. Then, what are you going to do with Yom Kippur now? Why does Rabbi Yehuda say only one base there and not two bases? Put down two bases by the Mizbech Zav, right? Seir and right Par. Why do you have to only put one base over there? Mishum chusha de kohen gadol labadate. Now we add in another variable, which is, you're right, labeling works, but that's when everybody is in full sound mind and body. When you're healthy and you're going to take care of things, people look at the labels. Kohen gadol yom kippurim is overwhelmed with the avoda. He's fasting. He has a weakness. I mean, he's really, it's too much for him. And so it's easily for him to get confused, even if it's labeled. So we want to take away any possibility of a mistake for the Kohen Gadol. Therefore, we don't do this. Delilo temahochi. The Gemara says, because if you don't say it this way, below tivanami, forget about labeling. Why do you have to label these at all? Said that a seir and a par look very different. Not just the animals themselves, but their blood too looks different. Hai nafish vaizutar. A cattle versus flock animals have significantly more blood. I mean, that's both volumetrically and weight-wise. If you have to do the Kabbalat Adam for a par versus the Kabbalat Adam for a keves or a seir, you're talking about huge differences in volume. So what are you going to say? V'chitei ma'olom mekabalei v'kulei? He had a Kabbalat Adam, but he didn't take all the dam of the par. So now they're at an equal levels volumetrically. It says, V'amar Rabbi Yehuda, we just saw this before in the Gemara, ha'shochei tzarich shikabalot kol damo shel par. When you do Kabbalat Adam, you have to take everything. Sh'nemar v'et kol dam apar yishpoch yisod. Mizbach ha'ula. So there you have to take all the blood of the par. So you don't have a choice. You're going to take all the blood of the par, all the blood of the seir. If you look at that, then what do you mean a label for? He should be able to just look in and say, this is par, this is seir. Okay, so what do you say? He spilled some of it. So if he spilled some of it, now they're even. So you can't tell the difference anymore. Hai chivar v'hai sumak. This one is white or whiter in complexion. The other one is redder in complexion. If you remember back from the Gemara, back on Mem Vav, we said there with regards to gold, that there was gold that was called the Parim gold, because it was like Dam Parim. It had a reddish tint to it, a reddish side to it. So the Dam of Parim is very red. So when you come to Dam Parim, it's very red. The Dam of the Seirim is much lighter. It's much more pale. It's a whiter type of Dam. Ela, Mishum Chusha de Kohen Gadol Lavadate. What you have to say in all these situations is that the Kohen Gadol is just not focused on these things. He has all these markers that would distinguish between par and seir, volume, color, labels, yet we still don't trust him to do it, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda says one base there because we don't want him to make any mistakes. So once you've described that as being the reason, so too by the labeling, we're going to say the Chulshah de Kohen Gadol was what precludes us from doing such a thing. How denachid kame de Rovo? This individual went down before Rovo. Going down means you're a shliach tzibur. You're raid lifnei hateva. You go down. The reason is that the place where the shliach tzibur stood was lower down. And that's based on the pasuk from Shir Malot, Mimamakim, Praticha Hashem. So therefore, generally, by the place where the shliach tzibur stands, they have a depression. One place that I really saw in Baltimore, they had the shul there, but they actually had a couple of stairs down, and they... Alright, so good. So Mara Pag shul also has it, you had two steps down. Right, the shliach tzibur is really down. Nachit means to go down, means that someone's going to be the shliach tzibur. So he's doing the avodah Yom Kippur, he's doing Mustafa Yom Kippur, and their day they didn't have the printed machzor. So he's going through the avodah, and he says, came out of the Kodesh HaKodeshim, and he put it down on the second base that was there, in Eichal. Notol dama par, v'niach dama seir. Then he picked up the dama par, and he put down the dama seir. So he says, wait a minute, Amalei, you're doing two things here. Chadak Rabbanon, v'chadak Rabbi Yehuda. You're doing half the avodah like Rabbanon, and half the avodah like Rabbi Yehuda. So the Rabbanon, he says here that there's two kanim, because he said that there's a kan sheni, and there's a kan rishon, means that there's two. Two means that we're talking about the Rabbanon. Now, if you have the Rabbanon and you have two bases there, what you're going to do is, he comes out of the Kodesh HaKodeshim with the Dam HaSeir, he's going to put down the Dam HaSeir and then pick up the Dam HaPar, because he has the ability to put it down before he picks up the other one. Yet, what he described here was, first he picks up the Dam HaPar, and only afterwards put down the Dam HaSeir, which is Rabbi Yehuda's Shita. Rabbi Yehuda's Shita is he has to pick up the Dam HaPar first to free space to put down the Dam HaSeir. So he says, you're inconsistent in your presentation of the Avoda. Ema, you got to say, Heniach Dam HaSeir v'natal Dam HaPar. First he put down the Dam HaSeir, and then he picked up the Dam HaPar in order to be consistent. So that you do the avoda. And obviously he's saying like the Rabbanon, which is that there are two kanim here, and therefore put down the Dam HaSeir, and then only afterwards pick up the Dam HaPar. And now, continue. Bizami menu al parochet keneged aron bibachutz. The Mishnah says that he repeats the avoda that he did bifnim in the Kodesh HaKodashim. He now repeats it outside on the parochet. Not literally on the parochet, but lifnei ha-parochet. on the ground in front of the parochet, he does this centered. When he's centered in the Kodesh, facing the Kodesh Kodashim. How far away he is from the parochet is a good question. The Rashash in Maros Daf has a big chiddush that he's standing way back. That he's standing like 10, 20 amot back from the parochet. Although most people think he's standing pretty close to the parochet. Again, to discuss tomorrow's Daf about Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi, who goes to Rome and finds the parochet with dam on it. So all these people are trying to come up with a reason why there's dam on the parochet. So if you start much further back, there's a good chance that you hit the parochet because you're not doing exact type of throwing because there's such a long distance between you. All right, Tan Rabbanan. B'chein yasil omoed. It says in the pasuk, after you do the matan dam aseir, when you come out again, the psukim say about the matnot dam, chiper al kodesh mitmo b'nei son b'shem l'chot dam, chen yaseh lo omoed, ha-shochein itam mitoch tumatam. So after he's done with the matnot of the seir in the kodesh ha-kodeshim, it says here that you do the same thing in the oel moed. Oel moed referring to the echal, to the kodesh area. V'chol adam lo yeh bo omoed, v'vol l'chaper b'kodesh ha-seito, v'chir b'abado v'abito v'ankol gal Yisrael. So here, nobody's allowed to be there when he's doing all of these avodot. So now, v'chein yaseh lo omoed, matam adomar, k'shem shemazel lifnai v'lifnim, kach mazeh beichal. Just like he does in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, so too he does in the Kodesh. My lifnai v'lifnim, achat namalo v'shev namato. You do one up, seven down. Again, the way that he positions his hand is what we're speaking about here. Midam apar, kach mazeh beichal. K'shem shelifnai v'lifnim, so too in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, achat namalo v'shev namato, midam ha-seir, so too kach mazeh beichal. So do you do it in the Eichal. So you repeat the same steps, first the par, then the Seir, one up, seven down. Ha-shochein itam b'toch tumatam, which is the latter half of the Pasuk, afilu b'sha'at she'in t'meim shina imahem. Even when they are t'meim, the shina is still present amongst B'nai Yisrael. It's a promise that Hashem stays with us, even though we make mistakes, even though we are t'meim. That's why, by the way, the Seir la'Hashem and the par that go in, or for Tumat Mikdash Ukdashav. That's all they're mechaper on. They're mechaper on the Tumat Mikdash. I mean, the presence of the Shekhinah is there. Therefore, we only mitaher the areas that we're doing the avoda towards the Shekhinah. So the idea of Shekhinu Tam Mitok Tumatam is because this is rectifying that issue. This is being mechaper on the issue, the fact that the Shekhinah has to be present, even though there are things that are Tmeyim. Where it says, Amalei Ahud Stuki the Rabbi Chanina. This Stuki says Rabbi Chanina. Hashta Pari Tmeyim Atun. You for sure are Tmeyim. Tichtiv tumata bishulah, because the pasuk in Eicha says that you have been defiled in the Churban Abayit. You've been defiled, and therefore you're definitely tameim. So he says, "Amalei taychazi maktivu." He says, "Okay, we're tamei. Let me tell you what it says about people who are tamei. It says a shochein itam b'toch tumatam. Vilzman jein tameim shchina shuria b'nehem. Being tamei is not such a big deal because Hashem is shoreh his shchina amongst us, even when we are tamei." Wait a minute. We have a principle in Kodoshim. The principle in Kodoshim, which we learn in Zvachim, is that you cannot extrapolate in Kodoshim. If you learn something from a Hekesh, then you can't create a double Hekesh, which is, if you learn one piece of information, you now cannot pass it on to another item through a Hekesh. In our instance over here, the only reason we know that the Dama Seir has 1 in 7, and the Dama Par has 1 in 7, is because we made the Hekesh between Par and Seir. So now what do you want to do? You want to take that information and now take it out and do it in the Heichal. That's a Hekesh to a Hekesh. You're saying what was true of the Paran Seir on the inside is now true of the Paran Seir on the outside. So Gemara says, V'chid amar lemeid v'hekesh, chuzer malei v'hekesh. Hai heimenu b'davar acher hu, p'lo avi Hekesh. The first answer of the Gemara says, this is something that's learned from it principally plus a Hekesh, and that's okay. So remember, each one of them had a piece of information. The Dama Par had the 7 Lamata, was missing the 1 Lamala. The Seir had the 1 Lamala, was missing the 7 Lamata. So that means if I'm going to Omoed, one of those items I can learn directly from Par, and one of those items I can learn directly from Seir. I only need the second piece of information to a Hekesh. The Dama Par, the Dama Seir, by both of them there's written a Matana Lamala and a Matana Lamata. All we're trying to determine through the Hekesh is the number that you have to do. That's called Hemenu v'davar acher. We learn it out from it, plus we have a little additional information that comes from something else. That's not a full-fledged Hekesh, and that's not a problem. That's okay. You can learn a Hekesh to a Hekesh when you're also learning something from the principal item that you're learning from. Here I'm learning 7 Lamata from Par. So I can also learn from that Hekesh the 1 Lamala. But see, here I'm learning the 1 Lamala directly from Seir. So the 7 Lamata I also can learn through Hekesh. Mehechi dami hekesh, what would be a hekesh in that case? A regular hekesh, not heimenu b'davar acher, is if we had to learn the entire matana of the malo, or the entire matana of the mato from one of the two items. Not just the number, but the whole matana, then that would be a hekesh la hekesh. But over here, we already have the matana, the malo, the mato, I just don't know the number, that's not called a hekesh la hekesh. So Mar says, Zanichon man damar lo avi hekesh. That works well going to the opinion in Zvachim, who says that Himenu b'davar acher is not called a hekesh. Alman damar davi hekesh, the one who says that's still called a hekesh and you can't do it, you can't have a double hekesh. Ma'ikon meimar. What are you going to say? He says, Mekomotu degamre mehododi. The locations are learning one from the other. The way Rashi explains it is that this is not a classic hekesh. The classic hekesh is where I take the same piece of information and then I extrapolate it to another item. I take A, gives me information from B, and then I take that information from B and pass it on to C. That's not exactly what's happening over here. Because over here, the hekesh is different. We're dealing with two different issues. We're dealing with location. One place is in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. The second issue is that I'm doing it in the Heichal. So the hekesh that I'm making between the Kodesh HaKodeshim to the Heichal is different than the hekesh I'm trying to make within the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Within the Kodesh HaKodeshim, I'm trying to determine how many sprinklings am I doing. So there, I'm going back and forth between the Seir and the Pyre, and I get the information. When I come out to the Ol Moed, I'm not trying to do that anymore. I'm simply trying to transplant whatever I did in the Kodesh HaKodeshim out to the Heichal, out to the Ol Moed. That's a different hekesh. It's not the same piece of information that I'm trying to transplant. And therefore, it's not called a double hekesh. The other way it is to know that we don't, it's not a hekesh lehekesh, but rather, in the same vein, we know that they have to be matanot that are done in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. We know there are matanot that have to be done in the Kodesh. It's just that we don't know how many. So the hekesh teaches us how many. But we've already established that there are matanot in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. We also established that there are matanot in the Kodesh. Now, I want the information about how many. That's a single hekesh that teaches me the information. So that's a different way to phrase a similar idea, which is that the information that I'm searching for through the hekesh, which is the 1 and 7 with the matanot adam of the par and the seir, are not necessarily the same information when I'm moving something from the Kodesh HaKodeshim to the Kodesh. So either that's not called a hekesh because I'm on different tracks, or because I already know that I have matanot in the Kodesh. The only problem I have is how many? How many is a single hekesh to tell me the information for both locations? As Rashi points out, so then what is a case of hekesh, the hekesh? And Rashi says, "V'echidami hekesh." What's a classic hekesh? Kigon, imlohu tzrach heichal limod min lifnai lifnim, ela mashal lamad behekesh. If it only needed to learn the information that it learned through a hekesh, which means that if it needed to know only the information about, for instance, the par lamala or the seir lamato, then that's a hekesh that you're learning. Over here, you're not really learning a hekesh. You're just trying to transplant a totality of information into another location. And so therefore, the two are not, it's not A, B, C, because the B to C is different than the A to B. And because of that, it's not called the hekesh, the hekesh. Okay, we'll stop over here.